want to pick a fight with a movie critic, tell whoever it is that you think you know what the greatest films of all time are, or even what the greatest films of the last 5 minutes were. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And on this week's show, Nathan Weinbinder and I will discuss the New York Times' list of the so-called 25 best films of the 21st century. And we'll offer up some select choices of our own. So don't touch that dial, because a critic special edition of Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
Free your radio and hear Spokane Public Radio wherever you go when you listen live on your mobile phone, tablet, or computer at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Just click on Listen Live, pick your station, and start listening. Tune in anytime for NPR programs, local news, music, public affairs, arts news, and more at KPBX, KSFC, or KPBZ. You can listen to all three live from our website by clicking the blue Listen Live link at the top. Whichever station you choose, SPR travels with you, keeps you company, and keeps you in touch with the world. Visit SpokanePublicRadio.org and listen live.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that loves a good argument, especially when that argument is about what constitutes good film. This special edition of our show was inspired by a recent list that was put out by the New York Times film critics A.O. Scott and Manola Dargis that purports to list the 25 best films of the 21st century. Well, as you can imagine, that started a discussion, not just between Nathan and me, but all over the country, which I'm fairly certain was the point all along. Anyway, we thought we'd take a look at the list and then offer up a few suggestions of our own. And I want to begin my part in this by just saying I have qualms about such lists like this. Why 2017 you're going to pick the top 25 films of the century?
Why not wait till 2020, right?
Because exactly.
At least you've got a round number.
Or 2025, there. The first quarter century
sure.
In the top 20. But, you know, this is clickbait territory.
Yep.
And so it's already, as you and I have mm-hmm. argued back and
I
forth,
mean, we're
it's
talking
all
about
over
it,
the internet.
So it
exactly.
Worked. Yep.
Exactly. It did work. But I'm always reluctant every single year that we put together our films. I always call my list my top 10 favorite films, my top 15. And so what I did was I looked at what A.O. Scott and Manola Dargis did, and I disagreed with a lot of it. There were about 8 of the films that I hadn't even heard of, much less seen. And so I had qualms about that. But beyond that, what I did was I came up with a list of films that had a profound impact on me. Films that slapped me upside the head when I was in the theater. And when I walked out, I thought that I saw the world a little bit different. So that's what I did. Nathan, what did you do?
Well, I want to say that I love lists like this, as clickbaity as they might be, because they do force you to kind of sit back and think, okay, if I were to make a similar list, what would I put on there? And that always sends you down the rabbit hole, right? And it's really difficult to take 17 years of film, or 16 and a half, whatever mm-hmm. you want to call it, and condense it down into just 25, because you're always going to leave off something that you didn't want to leave off.
Exactly.
You forget about something that you wish you had remembered. And so actually paring down the number of movies that we've seen in the last 16 years or so was really difficult. But I think it's kind of fun. And I always put out lists like this if I'm going to do it, with the caveat of saying, if I did this tomorrow, it might be different. So take this
yeah,
with a grain
exactly.
of salt, right?
Exactly. So, if I did it 5 minutes from now, it might be
exactly.
different.
Exactly. So after we talk to one another, we might change our minds about some
right.
of the picks that we made.
Yeah, you'll change your mind because you'll agree with my list.
I was thinking the other way around. but we do have our individual lists, and strangely enough, no overlap in our individual top tens, but there was a lot of overlap in our honorable mentions. But we'll get into
that. Exactly. Let's begin with what they did.
Let's talk about A.O. Scott and Manola Dargis's list. And they're two of my favorite film critics working today. They're the chief critics for The New York Times.
I agree.
And they're great. So I'll go from 10 to 1 here. Their picks are The Hurt Locker, Summer Hours, which is a film by the French director Olivier Assayas, Boyhood, the Richard Linklater film, Inside Out, the Pixar film, number 6, Yi Yi, which I believe is a Chinese movie that I have
not seen. And I never saw it. It's three hours long, and it's popping up on these
these lists.
I need to see it.
Yeah. Number 5, the Romanian film, The Death of Mr. Lazarescu. Number 4, another Chinese film, A Touch of Sin. This was kind of a surprise. At number 3, they've got Clint Eastwood's Million Dollar Baby.
Which wouldn't have made my top 100 list.
Yeah, probably not mine either. Number 2, Hayao Miyazaki's animated film Spirited Away. And at number 1, I don't think we've got any quibbles with this, Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood, named best film of the 21st century so far.
Right, right. What I found most intriguing about their list is that nowhere among the top 25 do they have anything by Terrence Malick.
Right.
And as far as I'm concerned, the number one film on my list, the number one
film. Oh, you're going to reveal this already. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, let's just, I mean, we don't have to, I'm not going to read all 10, but let me just start with the number one film on my list, which was The Tree of Life.
Mm-hmm.
The Tree of Life, to me, is one of the great films that I've seen in my lifetime. Came out in 2011. Malick has had an up and down career. I mean, you know, he's gone decades without making anything. But he's had recently a spate of films. I like The New World, which was one of the first films since Badlands of his that I really liked. But then The Tree of Life came out of nowhere, and it just blew me away. It helped that I grew up in Texas around the same time that the film is purported to take place. It helps that I was the oldest of three brothers, as there are three brothers in the movie. So I associated a lot with the film, had a distant father, so on and so forth. But it's just an amazing achievement. So the fact that it's not on their list anywhere astounds me.
Well, and from what I understand, the part of the criteria that they had here was that both Scott and Dargis had to agree that it was a great film or that it was a, you know, top 25 worthy film.
Right.
They're both very, very unpredictable critics, and it wouldn't surprise me if either Dargis or Scott was not a fan of The Tree of Life, and therefore it just didn't show up, even though maybe one of them thought it was great. I agree with you about the Tree of Life. I think it's one of the great films. It kind of made my runners-up list because it's a movie that's about, as you said, a specific time and place and about these specific people, and yet it's about this bigger, more cerebral thing, right?
That's right.
It's literally about the birth and maybe death of the universe.
Exactly.
And you see different life forms before humans existed. And yet somehow it never descends into self-parody, which some of Malick's post-Tree of Life films have
done. I agree.
And I think that it kind of represents the great culmination of everything that he's done in his career. And it is a great film. I'm not going to quibble with you there. So I guess I'll name my favorite film of the century so far, which also is nowhere on Scott and Dargis's list. And that would be Joel and Ethan Coen's No Country for Old Men, which came out in 2007, which I think is one of the great years in all of film. I think There Will Be Blood came out in 2007 as well.
Right.
Really, really good year for movies. And this was the one that I thought rose above the pack, even with There Will Be Blood in the mix, which is unequivocally a great film. This is a movie. It won Best Picture that year, which movies that I love that much never win Best Picture. Moonlight is another exception.
Boyhood's another one.
That did not win Best Picture. It lost to
Birdman. Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. It did not win Best Picture.
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay, so No Country for Old Men is, of course, their adaptation of the Cormac McCarthy novel, and it is just this completely claustrophobic, horrifying thriller about this man. It's almost Hitchcockian in a way, about this man that finds this money at this botched drug deal. We never really get the details of what happened, and then is chased by this seemingly supernatural killer played by Javier Bardem in his weird Davy Jones bowl cut hairdo.
Yes.
And so there is sort of this
Anton Chigurh.
Yeah,
there we go. Yes.
An Oscar winning performance by Javier Bardem there. There is this element of otherworldliness going on throughout No Country for Old Men. And that's present in a lot of the Coen brothers films, which are all earthbound and yet always have this element of there's something going on here. Their universe is working in a way that is never really explained and you just kind of have to go with it. And this is no exception.
Yeah.
And yet it morphs into this really kind of fascinating and morose meditation about mortality and what it means to age, because you've got Tommy Lee Jones as this sheriff that's investigating this case, and you expect these two threads to come together in a conventional Hollywood way. And we shouldn't expect that, because it's the Coen brothers and they don't do anything
it's
conventional.
It's the Coen brothers and it's Cormac McCarthy,
right,
who doesn't also. I mean, and that's the problem I had with that movie. And I'm going to have to go back and see No Country for Old Men again if I can sit through it, because I read the book beforehand and I had problems with McCarthy's books. And I love Cormac McCarthy, but
it's
like,
not one of his strongest works.
To me, it was like, well, I'm 2/3 of the way through this book and it's playing out like a standard noir, so I'm just going to kill everybody off and then I'm just going to go off in a different direction. That's the way I felt about the book, and the movie didn't fix that. The mystery itself becomes basically the MacGuffin, and it's
right.
really a story about Anton Chigurh and about the Tommy Lee Jones
right.
character and about good and evil and a whole meditation about that.
Isn't that what Fargo is about? Doesn't Fargo have a similar structure? I mean, they're kind of making the same movie again, but making it much darker, much less comic, setting it in a different locale.
Except that the Tommy Lee Jones character is much less of a factor in the film than the Josh Brolin character, who we lose 2/3 of the way through the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is his movie for 2/3 of the way through the movie, and then it transitions. So, like I say, I have to go back and see it again, because it was an extremely well-made, well-acted film. I just thought that the story, the screenplay, didn't fix what was wrong with the
book. But see, you're taking
the
story at face
value.
You're taking it as a standard noir film, and it's not that.
Yes.
It's about something much bigger than
that. I agree.
And that's the great trick of the film, is that you think that you're watching this Hitchcockian thriller play out, and then like the shower scene in Psycho, there's a moment where something happens and we take a hard left turn into something else. And that's the brilliance of this movie.
But I want to point out that the number two film on my list comes from that same year, and that was There Will Be Blood.
Oh, okay.
That Paul Thomas Anderson, you and I have talked about this. You don't like it as much as I do, and you don't like it as much as other P.T. Anderson movies.
Right.
But I think that this, as an adaptation of a novel, it's an epic film about California, about these characters, about the American spirit, about capitalism. There's one word that I've seen applied to this film, and it's bravura. Who would have ever thought that this guy could make this movie or would make this movie?
It's unlike his previous films, and he really hasn't made another movie like it since, because previous Paul Thomas Anderson movies, which I happen to like more, like Boogie Nights or Magnolia, were these kind of epic. I mean, you use the word epic, but those movies are true epics, these three-hour tapestries about all these different people living in a specific place and how they all intersect. And that kind of became a subgenre unto itself after those two movies. There's another film on your list here, Amores Perros, which does the same kind of thing. I mean, I think There Will Be Blood is a great film. I think it's unquestionably great. But I don't know. I guess I like messier Paul Thomas Anderson. And this movie is very rigid in its style, but not necessarily in the emotions that it goes through.
Right.
I want to call out The Master, his 2011-2012 film, which I think is his best film of the 21st century.
Well,
far.
We can talk about that when we get back, but we have to take a break right now. This is Movies 101, and we've been discussing the New York Times' 25 best films of the century and a few of our own. But before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to continue our discussion. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Nathan Weinbinder and I were discussing the New York Times list of so-called best films of the 21st century. Let's pick up where we left off, which was Nathan trying to defend his selection of The Master over There Will Be Blood, which is one of the great achievements of the 21st century. But go ahead.
So is The Master. I think they both are. Can't we just call this whole thing off and say that they're
really
both very good? Although you're not a huge fan of The Master at all.
I'm a huge fan of anything that P.T. Anderson does, and that includes even his most recent film, Inherent Vice, which, again, I didn't like that novel either. I didn't particularly care for the film, but he could make the dictionary. He could make a phone book and I would watch him because he's such an interesting filmmaker.
I think The Master is an interesting parallel to There Will Be Blood, because if you look at There Will Be Blood as a film about two men, I mean, you could argue that it's about the Daniel Plainview character and the Paul Dano characters, the possible twins, or as a film about Daniel Plainview and his son. Mm-hmm. The Master is the same kind of thing. It's this portrait of these two deeply damaged men. In a way, it's almost a romance because it's about how these two deeply damaged men affect one another and cannot possibly go on living without one another, even though they're also deeply damaging to one another.
Exactly.
And it's a fascinating film. And you talked about There Will Be Blood being a bravura film, and it certainly is. I think The Master is too. I mean, it's high wire filmmaking in the sense that you never know where it's going to go. The film itself is as unhinged as the Joaquin Phoenix character. And, you know, as good as Daniel Day-Lewis is in There Will Be Blood, it's a masterful performance. I think that Joaquin Phoenix gets overlooked a lot for his work in The Master because that role, I mean, he is just – he's stellar.
He's a terrific actor in most things he does. We read the top 10 list. I mean, we're not going to go through the entire 25 of the New York Times list, although I want to say – at number 25, The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Are you kidding me?
They could
Please.
Have at least picked, you know, Anchorman
Please.
Or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah, Anchorman. There we go. So why don't you just run through your top 10 list?
Okay. And again, like I said, this could change tomorrow. But today, right now in the studio, my top 10 best films of the century
one
so
to 10
far.
Or 10 to 1?
I'll go 10 to 1.
Okay.
Starting with 10, David Fincher's Zodiac. Number 9, Talk to Her by Spanish filmmaker Pedro Almodovar. Number 8, Pan's Labyrinth. Number 7, and don't laugh at this one, Kill Bill, Quentin Tarantino's martial arts epic. Both parts, it's one film. Number 6, Children of Men by Alfonso Cuarón. Number 5, Boyhood. Number 4, Her by Spike Jonze. Number 3, Moonlight, which just came out last year. Number 2, Wes Anderson's The Royal Tenenbaums. And my pick for number 1, No Country for Old Men by the Coen brothers.
You know, I was going through my list today and I had totally forgotten about Pan's Labyrinth.
That is a masterpiece.
Exactly. I mean, this guy never has to make another film ever again.
Right.
He'll keep making these
gothic
crummy little horror films. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
or
not
you know,
bad.
Something with Ron Perlman, you know.
I'd love another Hellboy movie.
Well, of course, that's probably what he will because he'll make some money at that. But Pan's Labyrinth, it was an amazing achievement.
And it came out the same year that Children of Men.
Exactly. And that should be on my list, but it isn't. That's my bad for that. So let me go through my list and 10 to 1. 10 was Blue Jasmine, Woody Allen's film. 9 was Before Midnight, and that's the Richard Linklater film. And that basically stands for all three of the Before movies, Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before Midnight. Although Before Sunrise, 1995, that trilogy is an amazing achievement itself. Number 8 was the French film A Prophet, which was basically the French version of The Birth of Michael Corleone.
Or Scarface.
Yes.
Maybe more appropriately.
Yes, exactly. And number 7 was The Dark Knight. I think that of all the superhero films that have ever been made, that is the best. And if nothing else, because of Heath Ledger's Joker.
No arguments here.
Number 6, Spirited Away, Hayao Miyazaki. Number 5, Dancer in the Dark. How could we not have a Lars von Trier film here?
I think we could easily not have a Lars
God,
von Trier.
Oh, God, no. No, he's one of the great filmmakers. Number 4, Mulholland Drive, David Lynch. I want to say it's his best film. It's one that had the most impact on me. Number 3, Amores Perros by Alejandro González Iñárritu, an amazing achievement, even more so than The Revenant or Birdman. And then number 2, we've already talked about There Will Be Blood. Number 1, The Tree of Life. So I think in any way we look at it, your list and my list, they are some of the best films of the 20th century.
You know, when you mentioned Dancer in the Dark, which is that really bizarre dogma
starring
musical
Bjork.
With Bjork.
Yes.
And it's a really interesting high-wire film. I think I've said high wire multiple times, but I think that's what we're talking about here. These movies that are taking these big chances. I should apologize to Lars von Trier because I don't know if he's one of my picks for the greatest living filmmakers, but Dan was wrong about how great Melancholia was a few years ago. And I think that is one of his great achievements. So
the
if anything,
is,
that should have been on your list and not Dancer in the Dark.
But Dancer in the Dark is very good. Dancer in the Dark, and the reason why
Melancholia
I put that
is just
there,
better.
Maybe so, but as you want to say, you use the term high wire act. He took a total chance. He cast Bjork, who's not an actress. It's a musical about murder and the death penalty.
And capital punishment.
And
it is,
go back to what I said at the very beginning in terms of my list of films. These are movies in which I said, the audacity of this guy to do this, the audacity of this filmmaker to put me in this position. A film that didn't make my list but could easily make my top 25 list is Gaspar Noé's Irreversible. There's a film that's told backwards, and it is violent and brutal, and yet it ends up like a love story because it's told backward. I came out of that movie going, how did he do that? I mean, it's just a movie that shakes to your very foundations. That's what I go to the cinema to experience.
I'm not a fan of his, but okay. I want to talk about my number two pick, which is a movie that was also absent from the Scott Dargis list. And it's a movie that I think gets left out in a lot of conversations, and that's The Royal Tenenbaums, the Wes Anderson film.
I think
the reason that Wes Anderson gets left out of these conversations is because his style has become something of a trademark at this point.
It's like film light, L-I-T-E. That's not my description, but I think that's what people think. Yes.
Right. And he certainly has made movies post Tenenbaums that are a bit wispy. But, you know, look at something like The Grand Budapest Hotel, which was that big epic film that he made a couple years ago. Really, really wonderful and inventive and full of surprises. The Royal Tenenbaums is a movie that, you know, I saw it when it originally came out and it really resonated with me. And I've seen it many times since, and it just deepens every time I watch it. And I saw it with an audience at the Bing a couple years ago, and it just – my love for it kind of, you know, blossomed all over again. I think it's very nearly a perfect film, and it's a movie that – walks this line between personal tragedy and slapstick comedy almost.
Yes.
And you've got this brilliant performance from Gene Hackman as this irascible guy who is just a complete SOB. And yet by the end of the movie, you kind of love him in a weird way.
Just as the way his children, they can't hate him, but they can't love him either.
And Anderson hasn't really had a character like Royal Tenenbaum since. And I think that maybe that's kind of why his movies have, I don't want to say devolved, because I've liked a lot of his work. I think Moonrise Kingdom and Fantastic Mr. Fox are really solid pieces of work. But I wonder if that's why his movies have kind of gotten, like you said, a little like lighter. You could argue that Steve Zissou has some of those qualities, but it feels more of a put-on than The Royal Tenenbaums. I mean, it's such a bittersweet little film, and I mean, every single character in it is so distinctive. The second they walk on screen, you know exactly who they are. He mastered his aesthetic in that film. He's kind of been echoing that aesthetic since, but I think that film holds up, and it's going to be one that lasts for a really long time.
Right. There are other movies that did not make my top 10 list, like just from the year 2000, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Yeah.
That was an amazing film.
Another Ang Lee film, Brokeback Mountain.
Brokeback Mountain, yeah. Talk to Her, the Pedro Almodóvar film.
Exactly. I think he's one of the great living filmmakers.
The Alfonso Cuarón's 2006 film, Children of Men.
This was before
he made Gravity.
See, folks, basically what Dan is doing now is going through and telling you why my list is so good. He's corroborating.
Yeah, these are all my also-ran movies. You know, and we talked about Spirited Away, but let's not leave out Pixar. Pixar was the American version of what the Japanese anime did. And WALL-E, I really liked WALL-E.
I'm not as in love with WALL-E as you are. I think it really falls apart near the end, but something like Up or the third Toy Story film or recently Inside Out, which is on the Scott Dargis list. Those are all really solid choices.
Right. There was a Russian film from 2014 called Leviathan by Andrei Zvyatnitsev. I can't pronounce his name, but it was an amazing film that if anyone's even remotely interested in what's going on in Russia today, you need to see that film.
Another movie that we mentioned David Fincher very briefly because I included Zodiac on my list. It was between that or another Fincher film, which is The Social Network, which he somehow made this caustic masterpiece about misanthropy and toxic masculinity, and it's about the founding of Facebook of all things. I mean, if that's not the work of a great filmmaker, taking that material and making something so invigorating,
the last two movies I want to mention are movies that deal with particular minorities and the way that they're portrayed in film today. Tangerine from 2015 by Sean Baker, and Barry Jenkins's Moonlight, which came out in the last year.
Guess what? Moonlight was number three on my list.
Ooh,
man, what a good list I had.
Well,
and Kill Bill. And Kill Bill.
Yeah, with that, it's as good a time to close this discussion as any. This is Movies 101, and I'm Dan Webster. And during the show, Nathan Weinbender and I have both been discussing the New York Times list of best 25 films of the 21st century, and we've offered a few film favorites of our own. Let's take this time to thank Jim Tevenin for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you too, our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot in the radio dial, when we'll again brave the world of contemporary cinema. Until then, remember the words of documentary filmmaker Alex Gibney. I don't like top 10 best lists. How do you rank Spirited Away over Eastern Promises? You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.